I look at the paper in front of me, which is the rundown. This looks like a good show. I think this is a show. And so it's our job to make it not suck. So I think we're all in for that, right? I think we're all ready to go. We have a great panel. Our good friend Wallace Norman is coming in. We're going to have book picks. We're going to talk to the novelist Margot Livesey, who's in our region tonight. It's all good stuff, and we're very, very happy to have you with us as we share in the bounty of this Tuesday morning broadcast. It is the 25th of June. It is 15 minutes past 9 o'clock. I'm Joe Donahue. Let me introduce our panel members to you, and we will get started right away. The Ulster County Comptroller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley. We are honored to have her here, March Gallagher. Good morning. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Honored to be here. Voted this morning on the way in. Want to remind people today is the primary. So if you haven't gotten out to the polls, you might want to do that today.
Yes. If your party is having a primary, go vote in it throughout the state of New York, and we'll obviously be having election coverage tonight, so it'll be all good stuff. J.P. Miller is here from the Empire Report. Dear friend, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me, and congratulations on completing the fund drive, Joe.
Thank you very much. It was very much the community coming together with a wonderful staff and crew, and we did it, and we're back, and we're more than a little happy. Mark Whitman joins us, investment banker on Wall Street and all-around good guy. Hello, Mark Whitman. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. How are you doing?
We'll turn... I'm sorry, Mike. Actually, why don't you go to Mike 5 there, sir? That is my... That's my bad.
How about this?
That's better. We can hear you now. He's Mike 5. Yep, he's Mike 5. And he's Mike 5. You're Mike Bowen. That's how that works.
I'm going to go vote today now that March told me I need to. The voting place for my district in Poughkeepsie is literally down the hill. I can walk my dog down.
Oh, all right.
Are dogs allowed in the polling
go vote
place?
No, but there's typically... it's at an elderly care facility, and there's always someone who's willing to hold the leash for our dear dog. And I remember for the last mayoral election, I had been haranguing the candidates about the fact that our little street, which is supposed to be a historic street, has been turned into a highway. And I had talked to all the candidates about their stance on this and listed the promise that they would help us. And on election day, I go down the hill. I was in my car. I think I was going somewhere else afterward. I literally couldn't turn into the polling place because there was an accident in front of them, which, of course, I sent all the candidates a picture of and reminded them of their obligations should they prevail.
That's good. I think you're – I know you've been on this for a long time, so
I'm working on it, baby.
Excellent. All right. We have a lot to discuss this morning. We will get going, and we thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you with us, and we welcome your letters. Just in case over the fund drive you forgot how this works, we talk about issues, and then if you want to chime in, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we'd love to hear from you, and we read letters throughout the morning as we discuss these many topics. Let me get to one of the big stories of today. A bit of, I think, an ending to a story, at least for the moment. We'll see. I guess we never know the true ending, but... WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange expected to plead guilty to a felony charge after serving 5 years in a British prison. A new court filing indicates that Assange is preparing to plead guilty to a single U.S. charge and will be allowed to return to his home country of Australia. This has been a work in progress for a very long time, and one that has been closely watched for a very long time. And the deal would conclude a standoff that began after the WikiLeaks founder became both celebrated and reviled for revealing U.S. secrets. barring any last-minute snags, the deal would bring to an end a prolonged battle that began after Assange became alternately celebrated and reviled for revealing state secrets in the 2010s. This is there. So he's going to be going to a U.S. Territory, a courthouse, Saipan, which is the capital of the Northern Mariana Islands. And then sentenced to be expected to about 5 years, the equivalent of the time he has already served in Britain, according to a law enforcement official familiar with terms of the agreement. It was a fitting final twist in the case against Mr. Assange, who doggedly opposed extradition to the U.S. mainland. The islands are a U.S. commonwealth in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and much closer to Australia, where he is expected to board a jet and head to Australia. JP?
What my big question is, will he continue to WikiLeak and leak stuff? That's I wonder if that's part of the deal. I think a big part of the thinking behind this is that he has been away in prison or restricted in his freedom for, you know, well over 10 years. And there were no, as far as I know, no deaths of American citizens as a result of his, of the leaks of intelligence information that he put out. That being said, the United States government obviously does have secrets it wants to keep and does not want to simply let off people that violate that. They want to have, for their employees and people in the U.S. government that have this kind of intelligence, they want a deterrence or a deterrent such that people believe that there will be a significant penalty for them if they do breach that trust. I, until today, didn't realize that Assange was an Australian. I thought he was an American. And have been studying up a little bit on it and talked to March a little bit in the green room about it.
I didn't know we had rehearsal. March, go ahead.
We couldn't help ourselves. I was questioning for myself, why am I so angry at him? You know, I mean, I don't feel that way about Chelsea Manning, who's the person who actually stole the secrets and gave them to WikiLeaks. And then after reviewing it, I realized, oh, Assange has done a lot of other stuff. It's not just the WikiLeaks material from Chelsea Manning in 2010s, but I forgot about the Democratic email leaks from the Russians in 2016 that sabotaged Hillary Clinton's campaign. And then in 2017, a release of CIA tactics, including the fact that you can listen to people through their smart TVs. So he really is dangerous and political. I agree with JP. I'm questioning whether or not there's going to be an agreement that he not leak in the future, and even how you would hold him to that while he's residing in Australia. Right. You know, Bob Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, called the impact of the original leak fairly modest. So I agree with what JP was saying, that there may not have been that many deaths involved. And I see a lot of debate about whether or not he should be given the same sort of First Amendment protection as journalists. I think you hear Joe, as a journalist here on, you know, a national public radio affiliate, can understand how important it is to protect the right of people to, you know, disclose and report on things. But he wasn't actually doing reporting. And, you know, what he was doing was really just dumping materials. And then lastly, and this is kind of a joke, I was wondering, is Julian Assange a Targaryen? Can anybody answer that for me?
Oh, it's a very good question. It's a very good question. You know what? And I bet there are listeners who've got this one set.
So he looks like characters out of the Game of Thrones series. Yeah.
He very much does. Ice and fire and all of that. Mark Whitman.
Well, he had a very friendly relationship at one point with Pamela Anderson, who also has pretty fair hair. So maybe he is a Targaryen. Yeah. Well, I know why I don't like Julian Assange. When he said, I enjoy helping people who are vulnerable, who he meant was Vladimir Putin when he leaked those Democratic emails. And also, Amnesty International doesn't like Julian Assange. They said that the leaks of information regarding those in Afghanistan who helped the United States put those civilians in Afghanistan at risk. So I know why I don't like the guy. The fact that he's a poster child for media freedom is a rouge. What he did with Chelsea Manning was helped her try to unlock secrets. Hacking's a crime. It's a serious offense. If you're at my front door trying to pick my lock, I'm going to have a pretty strong objection to that. And if you're at the front door of the government servers trying to pick their locks, they should have a strong objection to that. I'm a little disappointed. I don't think we should reward criminals for holding out long enough that we get tired of chasing them down. The other reason I don't like the guy is he was charged in Sweden, my recollection is, by at least two women of sexual abuse and rape. So I think there are plenty of reasons not to like the guy. I think it's a little disappointing he's getting off, but I understand it politically. I do think that David Byrne should write a Broadway opera about this guy, because if you look at the spans of what he did...
Better than that Marcos thing.
I don't know. I saw American Utopia. That was
splendid. That was amazingly good.
Yeah. So think about all the things that he's touched. The 2016 election... there's a tenuous relationship to the server information that was found. This is indirect. You'd have to stretch it artistically, but the whole Anthony Weiner case and the Clinton documents that were found on that home computer. There's the relationship with Putin indirectly through the RSU. It's not inconceivable that he, Julian Assange, dealt with people that Prigozhin knew, because that whole unit was one of the things that Prigozhin was involved in. So this guy's been involved in a great expanse of history, not to mention the fact that he had a very close relationship with Pamela Anderson for quite some time, and he was reported to have been in the Ecuadorian embassy on his scooter running around and smearing feces on the wall at some point. So he's had an interesting run. I hope he goes to Australia and disappears into a cave. And I hope that the constraints of his plea agreement make sure that that happens.
Wow, that's good.
I have a question on him being close with Putin. What I thought was weird about him is, why go to the UK? You know, I would think that the UK is too close of a United States ally for someone like that to go to. Now, Edward Snowden, I believe, is in Russia.
He's a Russian citizen now.
And leads of what one might expect a very nice life there. Why didn't Assange go to Russia?
My understanding is when they swept him up on the U.S. hadn't filed against him when he was in the U.K. Sweden had, and he ran into the Ecuadorian embassy, right, in like a child in a game of tag called Ollie Ollie In Free, and tried to stay there indefinitely. And then the United States filed charges against him. I suspect by the time he was in the U.K., they weren't letting him get on a plane to go to Russia to begin with.
I just want to note a couple of things that, you know, journalism brings to the table that Assange didn't, which is, you know, not necessarily exposing people's names, right? There would be an effort to protect people's identity and also providing analysis, you know, and those are thoughtful, you know, approaches to what could be very intense and damaging information that we expect from our journalistic enterprises that Assange did not bring to the table. And when I was saying, Mark, that I was thinking of the reasons I didn't like him, I was actually using that to cover up for my hate and disdain. Okay? So I was being, you know, polite.
Yeah. The freedom of the press, look, the rule is, I guess, if somebody calls you up and says, I've got these stolen documents, and you're the New York Times, you're allowed to go run to the bus station and get the envelope and then publish them. The expectation is you do so with proper redactions to protect people. If I were in charge of U.S. law, I would make that illegal. I think it's to traffic in stolen material is never a good thing. I think the excuse that the people who are for free press use is insufficient to justify stealing things from other people. But I get the rules of the road in the United States. But even under that, our current regime, he fell well afoul of other rules, including the hacking rules.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue in this conversation. We welcome your letters about Julian Assange, and we'll move on to other topics as we go through this morning in this half hour as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, March Gallagher, J.P. Miller, and Mark Whitman all make up the panel this morning. We'll be back for more conversation after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Great group with us. We have March Gallagher, J.P. Miller, and Mark Whitman. We also include your letters. We're discussing Julian Assange, and we are talking about the agreement to plead guilty in a deal with the U.S. that has been a long time in coming. And we welcome your thoughts on this, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I do have several letters on this, but before I get to those, does anyone have anything else they would like to add before we go to listeners?
I'd love to hear the letters.
Yeah, I want to hear what listeners have to say.
Okay, here we go. Your panel members don't like Julian Assange. One confessed to hate and disdain because he dumped information that was harmful to Hillary and the Democrats. How would you all feel about him if he had released information harmful to Donald Trump? Was the information true or false? If it was true information and it hurt Trump's campaign, you'd all be calling him a hero. That from Michael. Anyone want to respond to that?
I rarely call anyone a hero. I'm the person who expressed hate and disdain, and you'd have to do a lot more than release information damaging to Donald Trump to be my hero. But the concern goes way beyond just Hillary Clinton's campaign. So I'm going to just end it there.
Yeah. And Michael, my concern is not that I understand the rules of the game in the United States. You can dump information that you get so long as you don't break the law getting it. He and Chelsea Manning conspired to try and break the law to get information. That's that, and the fact that he's been accused of rape by two women in Sweden are amongst the reasons that I abhor his conduct.
Back to the letters. One of the most striking things about the Assange plea deal is that it demonstrates how much the politics of secrecy and intelligence have changed since he resided in the Ecuadorian embassy. With the proliferation of disinformation, perhaps bad actors no longer need to steal and leak information. They can just make it up and release it in such torrents to the most gullible and biased among us that it becomes almost irrelevant. Thank you very much. I think before the fund drive, I could have said that word. whether the assertions are factual or not. I think that's a great point.
Who's the, did you attribute the?
Richard.
Richard gets my gold star. That is a very insightful.
It's a great letter. I mean, and it shows just what happened in this period of time that he has been where he's been of how things have changed.
Now you could just have AI actually create fake emails for the Democratic or Republican committee, you know, like what happened to the Podesta emails that got leaked, and just make it up and just discharge it. Just say it's satire.
Well, but Richard's even right. The troll farms now, once they establish accounts that people attach to, right, they don't need real damaging information. They just need damaging information. I think that's Richard's spot on. But it's sad to think about.
What I would also say about the Hillary emails is that the emails, if you remember, I don't remember anyone being that particularly damaging, but how they were released was really meant to destabilize the campaign apparatus at a key point of time in the campaign. And I spoke to a very senior person on the Hillary campaign about this. And so it wasn't like he released all the documents early on in the campaign and got them all out. It was, here comes this trove. And then the Hillary campaign, instead of focusing on their campaign, is focused on going through all these documents and responding to press inquiries. And then there's another one coming in 2 weeks. And there's another one coming in 2 weeks. And so it was meant to paralyze a campaign of a candidate for president, whether you like her or not, or whether you voted for her or not. It was meant to destabilize our election.
Paul writes, Donald Trump's divulging the names of our CIA operatives to hostile governments may have led to the deaths of many agents, and yet Assange was hounded for 2 decades, and nobody died.
Well, do we know nobody died?
I was
going to
say, I don't know if we know that.
Yeah,
but,
I think
but,
we don't know that.
All right. Margaret says, I, for one, am interested to know that the CIA can listen to people through their smart TVs. How different is he from Daniel Ellsberg?
Well, you better fact check me on that. I read it. I'm not 100% certain it's true. You know, the 2017 CIA leak of documents from Assange. So I think it's going to take some research to make sure that's true. But, you know, technology is technology. And we do know that you can, you know, flip somebody's camera on their laptop and view you even when you think it's off. So I would just say technology is, you know, needs to be used with caution.
I know if my wife and I are having a conversation and we're talking about Houston, then when we check in to our Facebook accounts, there's a lot of information about Houston.
I've tried to get the algorithms to like do what I want. Like if I talk about vacationing in Hawaii, we'll just show me pictures of Hawaii. But when I try that, it doesn't actually work. So
yeah.
I think we should all check it out and see if we can get it to do what we want.
They know that you're doing that. That's why.
Then it's going into my brain. See, that's what I'm worried about.
Michelle says, I'm surprised at the panel's opinion of Julian Assange and his importance as a journalist who has been incarcerated without rights for many years. I do not consider him dangerous. Also, Joan, exposing illegal and reprehensible practices by U.S. government groups is the job of a free press. If these government agencies are so incompetent that they cannot even protect their illegal activities from journalists doing their jobs with increasing limited resources, then they are, and they deserve, exposure.
Has Julian Assange ever written a news article?
Not that I'm aware of.
I'm not aware of that. So it's hard to call someone a journalist if they've never written a news article. I understand the other arguments, but the argument of he's just a journalist and he should have freedom, if you don't write a news article, it's hard to call yourself a journalist, in my opinion.
I said that earlier. There needs to be analysis and there needs to be discretion about what you're releasing, where it's going to impact other person's public safety. And that did not seem to be the case here.
I'm just looking. He was an editor and publisher.
If he has written news articles, then I, you know.
Can I deal with another? The letter that said he had no rights, just to be clear, by the way, for the last 5 years, the government has been trying to extradite him from the United Kingdom. And they've expressed explicit concern about how incarceration and the pursuit of a case against him in the United States might affect his mental health. So this guy, to say that he was somehow without rights is absurd in the face of what's taken place and the way he effectively used the legal system to not only forestall, but I would argue actually evade proper responsibility for his illegal hacking. The fact that he was a journalist on the side is not why I object to his conduct. And when Amnesty International says that you're risking the lives of innocent people in Afghanistan, I think I'd take a careful look at that before I decided the guy was blameless.
Let's go to John. I'm surprised and a bit appalled at the panel's sanctioning of the U.S. government's abuse of state secrets. What do they say? Democracy dies in ...
Darkness or red ink, if you're the Washington Post, depends which.
That's right. Good point, Mark. Let's go to Mary. I've been sympathetic to Assange until just now when I hear his action helped defeat Clinton. His effect isn't limited. As someone said, he helped put Trump in power, and that is devastating. Off to Peter, who says, once again, the panel exposes their own disordered priorities, hand-wringing and pearl-clutching over the illegality of the hijacking, but little to no concern over the, say, illegality of U.S. military conduct that leakers like Assange work to expose.
I am wearing my pearls today. How did he know?
Yes. Keep clutching. I like how the letter things that you all work together? Like you have a meeting ahead of time.
In the green room.
Yeah. Let's see. Michelle says, I'm surprised at the panel's opinion of Julian Assange and his importance as a journalist. I think I read that one and I apologize. Sorry about
Joe,
that.
Joe, can I go back to the last letter? Just to say, you know, our comments today are bouncing off of the fact that there has been an agreement to plead guilty here and not really a review of the materials that were released in the 2010 leaks. And so I'm not necessarily condoning the actions of the federal government here. I'm really speaking to Assange's, agreement right now and the time served, and to look at, you know, his actions beyond just the 2010 leaks. So I just want to say, you know, speaking for myself and probably everybody on the panel, this is not a carte blanche approval of the actions that were uncovered by the 2010 WikiLeaks.
All right, let's take a break there. When we come back, we'll continue and move on to other stories. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Is this still Peter Frampton? No? Okay. Horace Silver on this morning. Horace Silver. And we are playing that music as our bumper music this morning. You can find out more about it by going to WAMC.org/roundtable, WAMC.org, WAMC.org/roundtable. Savvy, if you've heard this, but there is on Thursday going to be a debate.
I'm getting my popcorn ready.
In Atlanta. At CNN headquarters. Have any of you...
Ted Turner country.
That's right. Have you ever been to CNN headquarters?
No.
Okay.
Have you?
Anyone ever been there?
No.
Okay. Here's the most interesting thing that I can tell you. Probably you're all too young to remember this, but I'm going to try it again. Ray will know this.
Ray knows everything.
But... the CNN headquarters was the site of the Sid and Marty Krofft indoor amusement park. And when that went belly up in the 70s, do you remember Sid and Marty Krofft? They were puppeteers.
Can I buy a vowel?
And I think they were Canadian puppeteers. I could be wrong, but I believe they were Canadian puppeteers. And they had these big like H.R. Puffin stuff and all that stuff. Do you remember all this?
I remember H.R. Puffin stuff. Yes.
Yeah. And so they decided that they were going to build this huge indoor amusement park, and thereby building that, a million people a year would come to see the proceedings. And nobody came. And so, but the coolest thing is that when you go into CNN headquarters now, and you can still sort of get the vibe of it being the Sid and Marty Krofft amusement park. This is a big escalator in the middle that goes up like 10 floors. There's all kinds of wild things. There was a human pinball machine in the museum. It's very, very cool. And that's where they'll be having the debate. Isn't that great? Okay.
Sigmund and the Sea Monsters.
There you go.
Saturday
that was
morning
one.
Television.
That was one.
And these guys also produced, I looked this up, of course, The Land of the Lost.
The Land of the Lost. Yes. Yeah. They were mega famous. And so much so that they could open an indoor amusement park. But if you look at some of the old pictures of that building, it really doesn't look that much different now. With the exception of, you know, CNN anchors.
Well, let's see during the debate which of the two candidates ends up in the Land of the Lost.
In the Land of the Lost. That's right. So President Biden, I have to say, when I went to CNN headquarters, I was much more interested in seeing the sort of the bones of the amusement park than I was.
That's the lens you were looking at it.
Well, I wanted to know how much they kept. Well, how much they appreciated the history of the building. And they actually did a pretty good job. There was a couple things in there that gave you the sense of what it was.
Slee stacks in the hallways.
That's right. All that good stuff.
I remember those.
President Biden's aides are working to position him as a campaign season fighter who can counterpunch on the fly and combat voters' concerns about his age. It was announced yesterday that the president of the United States would be remaining at Camp David until debate time on Thursday, where a movie theater and an airplane hangar have been outfitted with lights and production equipment to create a mock debate stage. At least 16 current and former aides summoned from Washington and Wilmington whiz back and forth on golf carts to join President Biden in strategy sessions. Mr. Biden is entering his fifth day of preparations at the presidential retreat in the woods of Northern Maryland for Thursday's debate against Donald Trump. Camp David has become the epicenter for an administration and campaign effort to help Mr. Biden shake off the rust that often comes with being an incumbent on the defense and combat widespread voter concerns that he's too old to be an effective president of the United States. Both candidates are out of practice as debaters, and Mr. Biden's top advisors, including Ron Klain, who is managing the debate preparations, are aware of the missteps incumbents have made in the past. In 2012, President Barack Obama flailed in his first reelection debate and had to quickly reorient for the second. So they will be working to position Mr. Biden not only as a president in the midst of a reelection campaign, but also as a fighter who can counterpunch on the fly Mr. Trump, an opponent who is adept at extemporaneous insults, skip the primary debates that could have sharpened his skills. He now, over the last few days, has been on the road and been doing a series of rallies to get him ready, and also has, while at these rallies, has been downplaying. There was a lot of, obviously, Biden is feeble, and Biden can't do this, and Biden can't do that, and now he has said that he is probably going to be good at debating, but that's because he'll be on cocaine. So, or on something, I believe.
Jacked up.
Jacked up, yes. So,
takes one to know one, maybe?
That's now. According to people familiar with the planning at Camp David, who were not authorized to speak, but did anyway, the work days vary in length and are not rigidly structured. Mr. Biden and his most trusted advisors work on what they think would be best to refine or practice in that very moment. We will know on Thursday night. This has to be like Christmas morning for you, JP.
It is. And it only happens. Christmas is once a year.
Yeah.
This is only once every 4 years. And this is the best. You have to pop your popcorn. You have to have the biggest screen. You cannot be distracted. And you have to enjoy it. Now, that New York Times article you sent around was interesting in that debate prep for a political operative is like the Super Bowl. You want to be with the President of the United States as they debate prep. And that's why you saw no less than, I believe, 15 or 16 staffers leaking to the New York Times that, oh, I'm important enough to be with the President at Camp David doing debate prep. I'm really excited. The expectations game is a lot of what this is about. I think that Americans have low expectations for how well Joe Biden will do, and they have high expectations for how well Donald Trump will do. I think those expectations are a little misplaced in that my view is that Biden beat Trump in both debates 4 years ago. He had a much different tact than Hillary Clinton had, which is Biden is really good at smiling and laughing off Donald Trump's insults and allegations, which in turn frustrates Donald Trump and turns his face red. Hillary had a different tact that wasn't, in my view, as effective and allowed Trump, I think, to really perform well in those debates versus Hillary.
There's that great moment at the debate where Donald Trump comes out from his side of the stage. Joe Biden comes out on his side of the stage, just looks at Trump, puts his hands up and says, well, there you are. And I'm like, okay, that's a great way to start. Like, what else can you do after that? That's fantastic. But yes, I think he's very seasoned in that regard. Mark.
I was surprised when the article mentioned an airplane hangar and a movie theater that they gussy up for the level of preparation. Seems like a lot of work. If I were the Biden campaign, the one thing I would do in preparation for this, I think if you look at the last two debates, last presidential cycle, you want COVID Trump is the easier one to beat. He was far less linear in his thoughts and presentation than even he is normally. And what I would try to do if I were the Biden campaign is get surrogates, probably starting today, to try and get the message to Trump that, hey, Donald, this debate really matters to you. You know, Joe Biden may or may not be president come early next year, but you may or may not be in a courtroom worried about your freedom for potentially the rest of your adult life. And so I would try to emphasize to Trump what the stakes are. It's sort of the technique of a straight right of a boxer to really sort of tick off your opponent and get him emotional in his response. It's clear that they've prepared Biden for either the emotional Trump or the business-like Trump. These debates are decided on when you turn off your TV or the radio and you're a voter who's going to be swayed by debate, the question you answer is, which of these two men is more likely to help me out?
I also realize that there is this is a very little snack-sized morsel, a little soupçon of what is possible. But when Biden walked in for the State of the Union address and went up against Marjorie Taylor Greene, you're like, oh, okay, this guy can handle. Like, if he's ready for that sort of extrapolated, I think, or whatever comes, it doesn't seem like any of that's really going to surprise him.
I think he should be fine. If you look at his biggest vulnerability, the problem for Biden in this election and in this debate will be the following. The headline in terms of what voters care about is how they're doing economically. The answer is they feel badly about it, and Trump's going to try to Reagan-like make Biden wear that. He's going to ask people, you don't feel like you're better off, do you? You don't, because this guy can't control inflation. Now, when Trump goes down to issue two, which is the border, I think Biden's pretty ready given the stunt that we all know that Trump played in terms of removing the football. But I think the pivotal, if it becomes a debate about issues, the pivotal issue for Biden will be, can he combat the are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
March.
It's the economy, stupid, right? That is the number one thing that Pew poll shows that Americans care about in this discussion. I see everybody giving advice to President Biden about how to handle this debate, including people like Dan Quayle, who recommends Biden try to make fun of Trump and make him mad. I see, people on Fox News commentators saying he's got to get fired up to keep his train of thought and Trump has to calm down. And Hillary Clinton has an article today in The New York Times. I recommend looking at it. Her advice about how to handle the debate. She's the only person, actually, who's debated both of them. And I think it's telling that this is really the first time ever that we're having two presidents on the debate stage together. And it's the first time since 1892 that we have a past president and a current elected president competing in a presidential race. So there's a lot of history here. They've got to stick to the issues. I think take everybody's advice. But if I were advising President Biden, my advice would be get a good night's sleep. Because you got to be rested and ready for this thing. And
I forget that. Nap time. Nap.
I don't really mean to be making a joke out of it. And I want to say one last thing, bouncing off what Mark was saying about the two sides of Donald Trump. Everybody's saying, and Trump himself was saying, should I be tough and nasty or should I let him speak? There are two different types of Trump that could come to the debate stage. I actually think there's a third type of Trump, which is one that blows off this debate. And I honestly, if I was a betting woman, I would really question whether this debate is going to happen. I'm still in that place. I need to see it to believe it.
We had many people on the panel yesterday, both our commentators and people who were writing in that believe that to be the case, too, that they'll believe it when they see it. and could very well just walk off. I just want to make I'll get this out of the way real quick, but the debate is a CNN debate, and they're making it available to other broadcast entities. Though through a disagreement with NPR, we will not be airing the debate.
That's so brutal.
It is boggling to my mind that public radio will not have the rights to a presidential debate, one of two, which is not overseen by a debate commission, which was obviously worked out between the parties. But because of an issue with NPR and CNN, they will not be broadcasting
it. That is so
bad. With that said, the video will be on our website. So if you go to WAMC.org, you will be able to watch it there. So
that also brings up a couple things other than the candidates, which is CNN's broadcasting it. Jake Tapper is moderating it.
And Dana Bash.
And Jake Tapper hates Trump, but he also does not want to be seen as a pushover. So I think you may see him give Joe Biden some tough questions. I also think a big factor is going to be that the mics are going to be turned off when it's not their turn. And how that goes is something that I don't believe that we've seen in other debates with Trump and presidential debates, which is with the mics turned off and how that's going to work.
And you're going to hear a lot about the fairness of that. And also the fact that there's no studio audience. It will just be a very limited number of people in that room who are responsible for putting the debate on the air. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. All of that and more after this. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have March Gallagher, J.P. Miller, and Mark Whitman with us this morning. And we thank you all for being with us, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We have been talking about the debate that is coming up on Thursday night between Joe Biden, current president of the United States, and Donald Trump, former president of the United States. And as March indicated, the first time two presidents, former and current, will be on stage at the same time. I mentioned this just as we were going in. I do think that it not having an audience will make a difference for all parties involved. Because you're not playing to that audience, which has been the case in the past.
Sometimes I feel like there are usually three debates, and one of them is interacting with the audience. One is with an audience that they're not interacting with, and one is in a studio, typically sitting down.
Yeah.
And those are different things to keep in mind. I also think that the timing of this debate being before the national convention certainly brings up the question, which Republicans are talking about a lot, which is if Biden really doesn't come with his fastball, that they might be able to swap him out before the convention. And
I cannot see a world where that happens.
Not happening.
I just don't see that happening.
I think it's remote, but and I forget which survey it was, but only 30-some percent of Americans when polled. Let's all agree polls are
broken.
Well, they're imperfect, but believe that Biden is capable of serving his next term. If he has significant problems between now and some point when this election is finished, I want to beat Trump so badly that I would be willing to take any Democrat, and I would suggest that the party would take any centrist Democrat. I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility. I think it's extraordinarily unlikely. But I honestly, ask yourself this question. This guy, Biden hasn't gained much on Donald Trump, despite all that's happened and despite who Donald Trump is. And only 30-some percent of Americans think he's fit to be president. Would another would a centrist Democrat be able to do better?
I don't know. I understand what you're saying. I think we had this same, to me, it's the same discussion, which was during the primary campaign in 2020, when you had all of these Democratic candidates and nobody was leaping up. This is before Biden emerged in South Carolina. And oh my goodness, we don't have anybody. And then everybody started talking about Mike Bloomberg. And then, lo and behold, Mike Bloomberg comes into the race in the last, what, a month? And there's your centrist Democrat. And so I don't know. It just seems like we want these things, and then when they come, we're like, okay, but he didn't play the game. He didn't go through the process. This person is not up to the same caliber. And again, who are you gonna get? Like if there was somebody ready, like in the makeup chair, ready to go, I would say, okay, maybe. But well, who's that?
So that actually raises the second complication with this. First of all, I would argue these are different times because of Biden's age and because of dastardly his opponent is, frankly. So I get.
Well, he was still old 4 years ago, and his opponent was still dastardly 4 years ago. And by the way.
No, but his opponent's revealed himself as worse. And if I check the tables, I don't think Biden's got any younger. And he doesn't look younger. I mean,
I agree with you, and I want to hear what you have to say. Honestly, I do. There's one thing I don't quite get. We voted for a guy who was 78 years old. We know it's for a 4-year term. Guess what? People age. 4 years ago, I was 52. I'm not anymore. That's how it works.
But you didn't hold yourself out as a transitional figure, and he did. And you don't move as stiffly and have trouble. I mean, Biden's got.
Oh, you don't know.
Biden has a habit, in order to combat his stutter, of squinting really hard and trying to get the next word out. And when you do that as somebody as his age, it doesn't look great. The reason why March, and I think it was Richard, talked about, well, you don't even need real information these days. You can just use false information. And the reason why Biden is so susceptible to these snippets of him looking lost in translation is because of the way he presents even on a good day. Let me get to the other point about the person in the makeup chair is typically the vice president, which is the extra complication here. Because of the identity politics and the fact that we would all agree pretty quickly she's not it, you've actually got the extra complication of not only do you have to not nominate Joe Biden, even if he agrees to it, you've got to skip over Kamala Harris and get to a Whitmore or a Newsom.
I think that raises a really interesting point, which is I would be less shocked to see a change in the vice presidential candidate.
That's not happening. That would be more shocking because the identity politics of removing her, you would have to replace her with an African-American woman anyway, and the identity politics would scream.
Unless she decided.
No, but she can't decide because no one will believe her if she says she decided. Let me guarantee you this. Of the possibility of Joe Biden not being the nominee or Kamala Harris not being the nominee, she is the more certain of the two for all sorts of reasons.
The one thing that bothers me about this conversation, and no offense
only
to anyone.
Only one thing?
It's not us. I mean, I think it's important that we talk about it. But just the overall tenor of conversations like this is that we make it so Biden-centric and sort of forget that, oh, yeah, the other guy's nuts.
I actually think the other guy's nuts is why this conversation is so intense, because I want to beat the other guy. Joe, and I've talked about this, I would vote for your cup of coffee to sit behind the Resolute desk for 4 years before I would let Donald Trump. And I truly believe the country will be better off with that cup of coffee in that chair than Donald Trump. I want to beat Donald Trump. I will do what it takes within the bounds of Democratic rule. I think we ought to do what it takes.
I think Joe Biden is that person, and he's going to make that happen. I think when you see the two of them in this debate, you're going to see that Joe Biden is the adult in the room. And I think that's what Americans are going to want. Even if it's slower, even if there's a stutter, even if he squints, we'd rather have somebody sane at the helm. And I think you see this in the business community, and you see it, you're going to see it in the electorate.
You know, the thing about this, and we touched on this yesterday, that every time we've had these discussions, the last one being at the State of the Union, that, yeah, every time he walks out on stage, Democrats, like, hold their breath. I'm like, oh, my God. Oh, what? Oh, please, don't trip over the... somebody just airlift him in and drop him in. I get all that, but he's always performed fantastically. He's been prepped. He does a good. I mean, there was that one time, and I forget what press conference it was, when they asked him a question and he went back to the microphone. And I was like, oh God, don't go back to the microphone. And he did, and I was like, oh, that was bad. Okay, there are moments. Of course, there are moments. He is gaffe prone. However,
gaffe prone, I love that.
But I don't know. But again, when you see the two of them together against each other, I just I can't imagine. We'll see where we are on Friday. I can't imagine us having a conversation saying this guy isn't fit after and comparing his performance to that of Donald Trump.
What about the Supreme Court? Are we going to see a shocker of a decision? You know, at 4 o'clock on Thursday, that's going to hijack this entire discussion, or is it going to come on Friday, right? Because the term is ending. So I do think that could really change the discussion, because it's going to take people's collective consciousness to address whatever could be coming, especially if it's immunity. Yeah.
Yeah, there's the immunity decisions. Yeah. A number of decisions is still I'm not sure the moderators will allow that, but it certainly may be something that that the candidates decide to take on. I don't know.
The reason for the discussion on the Biden getting swapped out is because of the timing of the debate. Biden set the date, and he set the date before the convention. Once the convention happens, he is on the ballot. He is not going to be able to be swapped out. That is the reason, really, for the discussion. And I do think, Joe, I agree with you that the last two State of the Union addresses, I have been watching with very low expectations for how well Joe Biden is going to perform, and he significantly exceeded my expectations for both of the past State of the Unions. I think that expectations are low for him for this debate, and he definitely has the ability to exceed those expectations. He doesn't need to really beat Trump on Thursday night. I think he simply needs to exceed the low expectations that people have for him as to how well he'll perform.
I think we just have low expectations for everything, right? I mean, we just don't... I don't know. I mean, if we're done and both survive, like, here's the thing. If we survive it, right? If we, if we get through it and are like, oh, okay, maybe we can make a vote with a clear conscience. That will be something. I don't know if that's possible or not. I think you touched on this, JP, and I would just like to mention it a little bit about Jake Tapper and Dana Bash. They have been going under. There are a lot of Trump people who are. This was a case that took place over the weekend, but a Trump, head of the campaign went on CNN and got their mic. They got, brushed off and they left the interview because she kept on attacking Jake Tapper and Dana Bash. I would just like to point out, the Trump team, the Trump campaign, agreed to the terms of this debate. This debate would not be happening with these two individuals in Atlanta. By the way, I still agree with March. There's a really good chance it's not going to happen. But as of now, they agreed to the terms. So you can't go on there and start complaining about how biased everybody is when you agreed to the terms of the debate.
Well, you can.
Of course you can.
And
of
he
course
will.
You can.
And he's been calling Jake Tapper fake Tapper.
Yeah.
You know, he uses his special names for everything
but we
and
did
everyone.
This, we talked about this yesterday. He does the same thing with Fox News personalities. I mean, look what he did to Megyn Kelly. I mean, it's just, I don't know that it matters. I think it's whoever is in that chair and is going to ask him a question that he doesn't like, Republican, conservative, deep state, whatever, he's still going to get
angry.
And
he's going to say it was stacked against him and it's unfair no matter what if he doesn't feel happy with the outcome, just like the insurrection. You know, he's going to complain about it.
You know, the one thing I can't get over is we're literally talking about maybe he can hold his own. This guy's been convicted of felonies. He's talking about pardoning people who assaulted law enforcement. He walks by the graves of those who have defended our country and calls them losers and suckers. And we're worried that our candidate can't soundly beat this guy in a debate? What world am I in?
His former Secretary of Defense, Esper, says that he's, quote, a threat to democracy.
Yeah, that's the other. I can't wait if I hope they're coaching the hell out of Biden. If Trump dares to call him the worst president we've ever had, I would love for Biden to say, you know, I didn't know about all the presidents. I was uncertain on my history. But you wouldn't believe this, Donald. There is one president we had who, and just start the litany, right, who promised a wall and that Mexico would pay for it. Can you believe that? He promised to solve immigration forever. He walks by the graves of the fallen, our fallen heroes, and says the following. He actually said, I'm going to pardon people who assaulted law enforcement at the Capitol. Can you believe that president ever existed, Donald? That has to have been the worst. I mean, if Biden can't make mincemeat of the guy, what world are we in? I don't understand this.
We're also forgetting the fact that just with the most recent one was the immigrant death match of fighting them.
That wasn't that. What Donald Trump said is that he went to Dana White, who's head of the UFC, and he said you should have a tournament amongst immigrants, fighters who are immigrants. And there are plenty of immigrant fighters in the UFC now. They actually do quite well. There's no reason to have a separate bracket of them. And then he said they should then face off against U.S. Fighters. And by the way, there's plenty of national flags in either corner. I get that was a stupid comment, and I'm not a defender of Donald Trump, but it wasn't so fanciful or repulsive as the media has made it out to be.
All right. If you've read a novel called Chain Gang All-Stars by Kwame Alexander Ajay Brenya, I believe. I have that in the correct order. You would think, oh, okay, that's what he's talking about.
All right, maybe.
What's been left behind in the whole discussion is really the major accomplishments that Biden has had. I feel like, you know, we have seen a slight reduction, not slight, a significant reduction in inflation that's largely out of his hands, but we've seen him act on things like student loan forgiveness as much as he can. He has made some, you know, executive decisions on immigration that are significant. The bipartisan infrastructure bill law has not really even, the money isn't really out yet. I had people asking me the other day, like, what money's been spent in my community? And I'm looking and I'm like, it's not out the door yet. So these huge accomplishments have happened under this administration that really are not spoken to, that really are not daylighted, that really, you know, people just glaze over. And I think that's a missed opportunity. I hope that those can come through during this debate.
Kevin writes to us and says, when are you folks going to stop with the replace Biden hand-wringing? Imagine what any Republican operative could do with the Democrats dumping Joe at this late date. And please don't start with replacing Kamala. The race is on now. I know you guys love the Saratoga race meet every year, as you well know, and you don't get the chance to switch to another horse after the race has started. Wake up and get to work, you Democrats, says Kevin. Then we go to Michael. We say the polls are questionable. Don't evaluate either the poll sampling in any way, such as numbers of people in the sampling or any other element of the polls, or the questions asked in the poll. And then we harp about against Biden by referring to the same poll information to make an argument that Biden is in trouble. What nonsense. This is a pure the sky is falling opining.
I mentioned earlier this Pew poll about what is the most important issue for people, and people said the economy. The second was terrorism. The third, I found this so interesting, was reducing money in politics.
And I think that speaks to Citizens United. I think people are realizing just how much influence this PAC money is having on our elections and how messed up it is. And I think you're seeing that rise to the fore. I wouldn't have said that 2 or 3 years ago.
Ed writes, Mark Whitman's completely correct about needing to urgently replace Biden as the Democratic nominee. The day after November 8th, when Trump's overwhelmingly elected, Democrats and all their allies will inevitably be shaking their head and saying, how did we allow this to happen? Right now, Democratic leadership is knowingly sailing the canoe over the waterfall. Why are we doing this? Writes Ed.
Yeah, Ed, one problem is we don't have Democratic leadership. This isn't the old days where there was a there
is
a
smoke.
We
have a canoe.
Yeah, well, there's
somebody get a parachute.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think we talked about it before. These parties are like campers on the side of the road, and whomever gets elected, they and their staff get to then go into the camper and drive down the election road. By the way, I understand the infirmities of polls. Polls are supposed to be models that are pretty rigorous that allow you to look at and diagnose the real world. They're not the real world. But if you look at the current state of polling in the United States and you take a look at Donald Trump and you take a look at Joe Biden and you don't ask yourself why the hell isn't Joe Biden beating the pants off this guy— I think you're missing a step in the analysis.
I mean, the latest polls, we haven't gotten into them, but the latest polls from New York Times, CNN, I believe, have in the five battleground states, Trump is ahead at least 2 points in every one of them.
Yeah, although it's all within the margin of error.
Yeah, of course it is.
The one thing I found interesting was Karl Rove was on. I didn't see it, but I heard it reported. He was on Fox, and he noted the mild degradation in Trump's relative polling since the conviction. And his prediction was it doesn't stop and that Joe Biden will win because of it. And Karl Rove is,
Biden fan?
Yeah, no Biden fan. And he's nobody to easily ignore when it comes to taking the pulse of politics, particularly that of people who are potentially conservative. I thought it was an interesting remark. I offer it for nothing other than its context.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up, and we'll talk about all kinds of cool stuff when we come back. We'll do so with our wonderful panel, and we'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion. About 10 minutes left for our conversation with this great group, and we welcome your letters as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So let us talk, and I'm going to set Mark up for this if he doesn't mind. And while we're talking about presidential politics, an article in the New York Times, CEOs are frustrated. That doesn't mean they embrace Trump. Corporate executives complain about some of President Biden's policies along with his rhetoric, but so far they have not embraced and abandoned him en masse, abandoned Biden, and embraced Trump. This is, as I mentioned, an article from the New York Times when the White House chief of staff met with dozens of top executives in Washington this month. He encountered a familiar list of corporate complaints about President Biden. The executives at the Business Roundtable, a group representing some of the country's biggest corporations, objected to Mr. Biden's proposals to raise taxes. They questioned the lack of business representation in the cabinet. They bristled at what they called overregulations by federal agencies. While the meeting was not antagonistic, it was indicative of 3.5 years of executive grousing about Mr. Biden. Business leaders have criticized his remarks on corporate greed and his appearance on a union picket line. They chafe at the actions of officials that he has appointed, particularly the head of the Federal Trade Commission. But a number of prominent figures in Silicon Valley and on Wall Street, including venture capitalist David Sachs and Mark Andreessen and the hedge fund magnate Kenneth Griffin, have grown increasingly vocal in their criticism of Mr. Biden, their praise of former Donald Trump, or both.
Joe, I think that's an accurate, very accurate representation. First of all, I would say that the heads of corporations, believe it or not, their politics isn't necessarily decided by what's going to increase their EPS by a penny or two for the next 4 years. They actually are real people who think about this country and our democracy. They have very oftentimes very firm views, and they're usually not shy about them nor uncertain about them. That's the way CEOs, most of them, operate. But it's not surprising to me that they value somebody who is going to helm this country in a more stable fashion, that that's very important to them. Also, I would say that Joe Biden has regrettably succumbed to the temptations of protectionism. Donald Trump sort of opened that door a bit. Joe Biden swung it wide open. The risk is Donald Trump has threatened to, hey, Kool-Aid man, through the whole side of the door and the adjoining wall if he's put in as president again. So on balance, it is not surprising to me that many, if not most, business leaders, although not entirely enamored of everything that Biden has done, and it's worth mentioning his Biden's public pronouncements about inflation being caused by greed. Every corporate CEO rightfully scoffs at that. But it's not surprising to me that on balance, they're going to pull the lever for Biden and have shown their financial support accordingly.
Predictability is just too valuable. I mean, it's very hard to do business when things are vacillating as much as they were during the Trump administration. You just don't know what's coming down the pike, and it's very hard to do your planning. I remember those Friday night press releases that would come out of the Trump administration just wildly changing things on the ground, and I think business cannot tolerate that kind of uncertainty. So I do think you're going to see people at the top level of our corporate entities pick predictability and clarity over unpredictability and chaos, as one person put it. But I also think that Biden's comments about the business community have not been helpful. And he's had a lot of wins that have not really been made as public as I would like to see and not entered the mainstream dialogue. For example, reshoring chip manufacturing in the United States and some of the other activities to kind of bring business stateside, not necessarily speaking about tariffs, but investing in American manufacturing. And then there are other things that are happening, policies that are being undertaken by the administration that I, as a fiscal watchdog and as an advocate, really appreciate. And I know that these run counter to what some business people in the business community want. Those specifically are the way Lina Khan has taken the helm at the Federal Trade Commission in a very aggressive manner. I think we have really underutilized antitrust in this country over the last 30, 40, 50 years. And it particularly needs to be used to rein in our technology and social media companies, and she's beginning to do that, and also new rules at the Securities and Exchange Commission under Gary Gensler. So I know the business community is nervous about that sort of activist approach in those regulatory agencies, but I have to say, I think it's been great. And I'm hoping that people will see those exercises of authority as actually things that are useful to create competition and protect consumers.
Mr. Miller.
My view is that the CEOs are really focused on themselves and their companies and their boards, and I think a lot more of them are supporting Trump when they vote than they would publicly pronounce. I think you see guys like Jamie Dimon came out, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase came out during Davos and was talking about a number of things that Trump had right during his presidency. So while I don't think you'll see a lot of publicly traded company CEOs coming out and vocally supporting Trump like Jamie Dimon is starting to, I think a lot more of them will be supporting him in the ballot box than you might realize from reading this New York Times article.
Made a face.
Yeah, well, first of all, on Lina Khan, I think it's true the FTC needed a sheriff, but Lina Khan needs to learn how to shoot straight before she takes out her revolver in town. She's already hit innocence.
We don't promote gun use on this program, but go ahead.
So I get that we needed a more muscular FTC, but I agree with those who criticize her. As for, you know, Jamie Dimon, you know, given his unique position in industry, that he's got to play it closer to the middle than most because he's so visible, and the banks particularly are so dependent on government regulations day by day. And particularly Trump's threat to reduce the independence of the Fed is keenly of interest. So Jamie Dimon's got a, and others have got to publicly pull a stance that if, no matter who gets into the office, they don't want to have spent their influence in a way that would be detrimental to their businesses. And they owe their businesses that responsibility. They can't be like you and me and say whatever the heck we want, no matter whether or not it would get us cross with politicians. I do think, I actually, JP, I would say my experience suggests that when you talk to CEOs in a quiet moment, you know, over dinner or coffee or a drink, they actually do vote their Democratic conscience more than they vote, you know, next year's EPS by a penny or two.
I agree.
The only thing I would say is, if in the case of the CHIPS Act, I'll tell you, the reason you haven't heard a lot about that is if you're in an industry where the government's putting out troughs, well, then you go after the trough and that's your responsibility. But in general, businesses really don't like that unless it's the trough for them. Because what happens is the objective of industry becomes, I want to be at the trough and have the trough keep coming, as opposed to competing. You spend your time, particularly as a CEO, worrying about the government handout as opposed to competing. And I think that's one of the issues with what's, you know, I think the CHIPS Act has gone a bit too far, although it's been, I will say, early indications are it's been more successful than many people like I thought it would be in reorienting U.S. industrial policy. But I don't think you're going to see people cheer up and down because they actually, you know, the odds that the next trough is for them and benefits them without any cost is small.
They don't even know. People don't even know. They're not really conscious of the CHIPS Act or what it's doing on the ground. And I don't know that we've really seen the full impact yet. Manufacturing jobs in my county went down last month again, as they have almost every month for years and years. So, you know, it's a long-term investment strategy that's really hard to capitalize on in this short window.
Yeah, look, to ask the government to get a long-term investment strategy right at the cutting edge of technology is a dangerous play.
On those words, we will call it a panel for this Tuesday morning. My thanks to our wonderful participants, March Gallagher, J.P. Miller, Mark Whitman, you're all wonderful. I appreciate you being here. I thank you so much for your thoughtful debate, and I look forward to you returning soon.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Joe.
We'll be back right after this.